This podcast may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
In our last episode, we covered the early life of Gwen Arejo, a 17-year-old trans woman from Newark, California, whose life was cut short when she entered a house party in October of 2002 with people that she considered her friends. We talked about some of the pressures that faced the trans community, as well as some of the history of the struggle for LGBTQIA equality. Amidst this struggle, a 17-year-old girl was looking for a way to express the person she was to become in a world that's not always supportive or accepting. Gwen will suffer bullying at the hands of those around her. Even while her family accepted and supported her, she would seek out those who would see her for the young woman that she was. These new friends she would find would not become the safe haven that she sought, but instead would turn out to be another group that would judge, ridicule, and abuse her. This time, however, this abuse would lead to her murder. On this episode of California True Crime, The Murder of Gwen Arejo, Part 2. Welcome to another episode of California True Crime. On the second episode covering the murder of Gwen Arejo, with me are Sean and Jessica. How are you guys tonight?
I'm good.
So am I.
Excellent. Are you guys ready to dive back in?
I don't know. It's a hard one.
It is a hard one. But before we continue, I want to do a quick recap of everything to make sure that we're all up to speed. This will also give you a chance. If this is your first episode of California True Crime, stop and download the first episode in this story and then come back. And again, as with all of our episodes in this series, my information will be cited on our website, californiatruecrime.com. The majority of the information is taken from local newspapers from that time, the Mercury News, as well as the East Bay Times and a few others. You can always find a complete works cited page on our website, californiatruecrime.com. So, as a recap, Gwen Arejo, as we said in our intro, was a 17-year-old transgender woman that was struggling with coming to terms with her place in the world. Even though she had gained acceptance with her family and with a few close friends, she was still struggling with it in the rest of the world at large. She would leave school because of bullying and struggle with this seeking of acceptance. She would eventually drop out of school completely, looking instead to work and earned enough money for hormone treatment and eventually surgery. Gwen would eventually meet and become friends with Jason Caceres, Michael Madsen, and Jose Morel, as well as Jaron Neighbors, along with a few others at a house that Jose would share with his older brother, Paul. It was at this house that they would party with Gwen, drinking and using drugs. These parties would culminate in a fight that Gwen would eventually get into with one of the other attendees, Nicole Brown. This fight would be one of the first steps which would lead to a path that would end in tragedy on October 4th, 2002. As we stated, this fight between the two women would lead to dire consequences. Gwen would laugh this fight off and go about her life as if nothing had really happened. She would continue to interact with the group at the Morel House. Around the same time, Gwen had been looking for a job to earn money for cosmetology school. And this was a dream of Gwen's. She wanted to become a celebrity makeup artist. Unfortunately, she was having no luck in finding a job. In an interview her mother would give, she would say that this is due mainly to the fact that Gwen was becoming more and more discouraged at not finding a job. She would also go on to say that one of the reasons is that Gwen would show up at an interview with a prospective employer and they wouldn't hire her because she filled out the application with her dead name or birth name of Edward. And we've talked about this before. Again, we're referring to Gwen, and her legal name is Gwen Arejo. Her mother actually had her name legally changed posthumously. But Gwen, not wanting to break any laws, again, would put her quote-unquote legal name at the time on there, and an employer would see it. They would say there was a problem, and then Gwen's mom would say that this is a reason why she wasn't hired.
It is weird. It's hard because those applications, you want to do everything correct. And then, like, I'm wondering if during the interview, people just thought it was Gwen and had no clue about her past of Edward.
Well, and the interview that I saw with her mom was pretty specific. She said that she would fill out the application with her dead name of Edward. And I'm assuming that as an interviewer, if this person came in and put the application down, that those people might start to struggle with the idea of why is the application say one name, but you're telling me your name is something else. And again, this, we talked about kind of the world in 2002 and most people not being comfortable with discussing trans issues out in public.
This is also a really big issue still today. When I was doing the statistics for last episode, it's one of the biggest issues when people are trying to get a job or even when they're trying to move up in a company, say, or just if you think about it, go to the grocery store and you have to, you know, before you use your credit card, they want to see your ID. It can cause all kinds of harassment issues.
And as we talked about last episode as well, and what you'll see in some of our cold cases that we're covering at the end of these episodes, that is a problem when dealing with legal issues and reporting crimes, is they're oftentimes reporting the wrong person's identity. So Gwen's mom will in, like I said, in an interview report, this is the reason why she's getting discouraged. She's going to these interviews and getting turned down for these jobs, and that's going to lead to her kind of spiraling into a more and more depression. Again, we've talked about this last episode, and we will continue to kind of talk about this throughout all these five episodes, but Gwen is fighting against how the world saw her versus the way she saw herself, which I think is a big reason why she spent so much time at the Morrell house, is because according, they saw her as she saw themselves, or in her mind, this group of friends, and I'm doing air quotes because we know they're not real friends, but she believes that they see her the way she sees herself. And it's this group that's unconnected. So I think it's easy to understand that even after the fight with Nicole, why Gwen would go back there. So on October 3rd, Gwen would return to the Morrell house for another one of these house parties that have been going on pretty much consistently all summer long that she's been hanging out with this group. She let her mother know that she was going out. In an interview her mother gave, again, her mother, Sylvia Guerrero, stated that on this night, Gwen dressed a lot more provocatively than she had at other times. She was wearing a mini skirt, which highlighted her muscular legs, and she refused to wear a choker that she normally wore when she went out. The choker was used as a way to hide her Adam's apple. Ms. Guerrero said that she pleaded with Gwen to dress more conservatively and not take chances. After all, Gwen had already been in one fight, as well as had to have her mother pull out of another scrape sometime before this past altercation. So there's been two times, again, in Gwen's mom's eyes, I can see, you've gotten in trouble. I know you just want to go out and have fun, but you can get in, you can be seriously hurt. Please don't do something to put yourself in that situation. Now, I'm not going over the details of what Gwen is wearing so that we can in any way show that it was her fault for what will happen to her. I'm highlighting the facts in this story and possibly showing that, again, this young woman was just a kid and she was, like a lot of kids, not thinking about anything other than trying to go out with people that she took as her friends. Gwen did not, nor does anyone else, deserve to be treated badly because of who they are, how they dress, and certainly doesn't deserve to get killed over it. She laughed off her mom's concerns and will call her friend Chrissy, who also, we talked about last episode, this is a friend that would accompany her on a lot of these trips into the city, and eventually early on also became friends with the Morrells and the rest of the guys at this house. Chrissy actually would also warn her against going over to the house dressed the way that she was. Chrissy at this time will not go to the party, and Gwen again laughs off the concerns. Gwen will eventually go to the party alone.
I think it's really sad because on top of all of the stuff that she's going through and trying to figure out who she is, there's so much pressure, I think, on Gwen, on lots of people in society, to conform yourself not to the way you want to be, and you're not hurting anyone, but to the way society would prefer that you be. And then that gets kind of funneled through her family and through her friends. And that must be just a lot to deal with.
Yeah, and I think in some of the stories you'll read, and we talked about a little of this last episode, and it'll be something we go back to a lot. But when Sean, you talked about the idea of a pure victim, I think part of that too is when they're describing how she was dressed.
Yeah,
you know, like, again, it's another instance of, oh, she dressed this way, so she knew what she was doing. She's 17. What 17-year-old, and again, I can't speak for women in this respect, but I knew when I was 17 or 18, I was going out with my friends, you know, I'll put on my best shirt and a nice pair of jeans. I want to look good in case we run into somebody. You're dressing up to go out.
And it follows in the footsteps of a lot of other crimes we've talked about, sexual assault among mm-hmm. them, where there's a lot of blame on the victim for you're supposed to control someone's ability to commit a crime against you. And that's just not how it works.
Did Chrissy come to these parties a lot too?
I couldn't find any description in any of the sources that how often she went. I got the feeling that she did attend some, mm-hmm. if not all. I couldn't find reference to her actually being there when Nicole and Gwen got into their altercation, but it sounded like more often than not, Chrissy was there.
She went for the party, not so much these people. Like, it seemed like they were Gwen's friends.
Yeah, I that's what I got. You know, it's kind of like more, she was Gwen's wingman.
Yeah.
And you said there were other people often at these parties, right?
Yeah, and I think that often gets overlooked too. And we'll go into this as we kind of develop into what the crime is and eventually. And I know we're doing a lot of foreshadowing, but I think it's important that we kind of lay this groundwork first, is that this is a typical party house, I guess. And I know we've talked about this when we're not necessarily recording, but we've chatted a lot about, I know for me, there was always that one house that you knew everybody went to on Friday or Saturday nights because that's where the party was. You know, it's where the alcohol was. It was where, you know, all your friends would be. And it was the place to congregate. And it was, you know, it was always the four or five people that lived there. And then 30 other people show up. And I got the feeling that this Morell house is kind of like that. It's, yeah, there's four guys living there, but there's a bunch of other people showing up. Gwen will go to this party alone. In the episode of Fatal Encounters that we talked about last episode, Chrissy will lament the idea that she did not go to the party with Gwen and say that if she did, Gwen might be alive now. And I think that was a little bit of a remorse and survivor's guilt. It was really hard. You could see that they were very close. In fact, it seems like around this time, Chrissy's one of the only friends outside of the family that Gwen really has. That this is like her best friend and confidant. So that the idea that a choice you made could have prevented this must be a huge weight on her.
That's something that she probably carries the rest of her life. That it's really not her fault, but she probably cannot get it out of her head.
Oh, definitely, definitely. For the next part, we're going to go over the facts of this case as it was presented at trial. This account is based on the people's case in the court records. Once we've established it, we're going to go back over it and look at some of the details and the discrepancies as they conflict with some of the different accounts of the case from the perspective of the defendants. Now, it's important to note that there has been a couple of months of Gwen hanging around the Morell house, as well as spending time with Jason, Michael, Jose, and Jaren. So this is not, you know, again, this is October. She'd been hanging around with them since late July, early August. During this time, Gwen would become sexually active with both Michael Magson and Jose Morell. She would perform oral and anal sex on both men. She would claim that she was menstruating, so she could not have vaginal sex with either of them. Both men had commented on this to each other over the time that they knew Gwen. They would talk about this a few times as the weeks went by. They would talk about this in relation to the fight that Gwen got in with Nicole and how she fought like, quote, a man in drag, unquote. They also discussed how that she had a scratchy voice sometimes, as well as often wearing chokers and things around her neck, as if hiding an Adam's apple. They would even comment on the idea that she's unusually promiscuous for a girl of her age. Remember that they believe that she's 19 years old, when in reality she's only 17.
Where did they get that, where their chart on what a 19-year-old should do? Like, where?
Yeah, and I think this is, again, I think in every one of the, or I won't say everyone, but most of the articles that I dug out of the archives all cite to her sexual activity with the guys. And again, it'll become a central point in their defense. But it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Jessica. To me, it really smacks of a sexist way of reporting on the victim.
I think, and we'll see this several times throughout this case, and especially when it goes to trial and their defense. But there's a lot of interesting ideas that they have about things like consent and who is really responsible for, you know, deciding to have sex with someone or not deciding to have sex with someone. And they have a lot of sexist ideals in this case. I mean, that they're also having sex with her, but that she's the person who, you know, she's a girl for her age, for whatever it is, that there's a certain amount, like you're saying, Sean, it doesn't make any sense. But there are, I think, societally, ideas about how women act and ideas about how men act. And to them, they're not interested in their part of it, just that she's doing something.
Yeah.
And a lot of our slurs about women are kind of coded with sex, slut, whore, those kinds of things. So much of the story will be so sexist because they're using that system against her.
Mm-hmm. And I think in some of the highlighted examples, because I think for me, there was that question of how things are getting reported and what details they're choosing to put in the newspaper. And again, we've seen this in a lot of the cases that we've covered, is what's in the newspaper or covered on the TV news is the most, you know, salacious or sensational parts of the case. However, in no time do any of these articles, for I would say the majority of these articles, highlight the fact that these men are over, with the exception of Jaron Nabors, over the age of 21, are plying a minor. Now, granted, they didn't know she was a minor, but they do know that they think she's 19. So again, under the legal age, with drugs and alcohol, none of that is hardly mentioned. I think there's like a footnote in a couple of them, and I mean a footnote. I don't mean an actual footnote. I mean just a real quick line about, you know, alcohol and drugs were involved. Not the fact that, you know, who's supplying the alcohol at these parties? It's these guys.
Right.
Who's supplying the drugs at these parties? It's these guys or friends of theirs, you know? So again, I think it's putting the most salacious, sensational aspect of this is Gwen being a trans woman, and then like you said, Sean, this idea of, well, she's promiscuous, and that somehow makes her bad.
Right.
We will go over what the men talked about and when they did when we get to the trial, because that's really going to be a key part of not only their trial and their defense, but how people view this case. They would be feeding off each other, and at one point, Jose Morell would become very agitated at the idea that Gwen, now again, she's known by Lida to the guys, but we're going to continue using her chosen name of Gwen. So Jose is going to become very agitated at the idea that Gwen might possibly be a man, and he had sex with her. Magson, feeding off of Morell's anxiety, told him, quote, "Do you want to be fucking gay? Is that what you want? You want to be fucking gay," unquote. Nabors would also be witness saying that someone who did this would get themselves killed, but it would be hard to hide the body.
So they're really, in the weeks of coming to the time where they murder her, they're really kind of egging each other on already.
Yeah, and this will come out, initially some of this will come out in the first trial. Spoiler alert, there will be more than one trial, and we'll talk about those. But it's pretty clear that early on, they're talking about this stuff and what they'll do to somebody that, you know, that did this. You know, if, like they said it, you know, are you, you're gay because you did this. And even Jaron jumping on and saying, well, I'd kill somebody who did this, but I wouldn't know how to hide the body.
I almost feel like egging on is, that seems more like kids playing a game or doing something. This is like they're all stewing in a hot tub that they just keep turning on the heat because they're all just getting each other so riled up with their own hatred and feeding off of it.
Yeah, right.
And trying to show off to each other how manly they are, how they, you know, how they would be violent if that's true.
They're wanting, right. They're one-upping in their own thoughts of how horrible they could be. It's just crazy because it's just so, it's weeks of them just thinking about it and just making it, it's boiling their blood every day more. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, and what caught me too is it doesn't stop them from interacting with Gwen. It doesn't stop them from plying her with alcohol. It doesn't stop them from plying her with drugs. It doesn't stop them from inviting her back to the party. I mean, if you were that disturbed by what went on, then why wouldn't you cut off the relationship early on and say, we're done. I'm not interested in you. We're finished. But no, this is that she's continually going back and being welcomed back by this group. So now Morell, so this is Jose Morell, Michael Magson, Jason Caceres, and Jaron Nabors all went out to a bar on October 3rd, 2002. Now, Jaron Nabors is 19. I do want to bring that up. So I'm pretty sure it's never mentioned that he has a fake ID, but somehow he got into the bar and was drinking with the three others. They stayed there for a few hours drinking. After that, they continued to a local nightclub to have another round of drinks and would eventually leave around 1:30 a.m. According to witnesses at these establishments, all the men had seemed to be drunk. Once they left the club, they returned to the Morell house. Again, this house was a rented place in Newark that Jose shared with his older brother, Paul, and it was the center for the group's social circle. On this ride home, the group had decided that they would confront Gwen on whether or not she was a man and be done with it. Once and for all, they were going to get the truth. And again, I'm saying truth with air quotes. It's what they thought of was the truth. Once they got to the house, they would find Nicole Brown, Paul Morell, and Manny Morell. And this is, Manny is Jose and Paul's youngest brother. He's closer to Jaron's age. I believe he's around 19 or 18. As well as Gwen already there. At this gathering, there's also reports that there was a lot more people than just this small group of friends. And I want to highlight this because what will happen is, we know where this is leading, but what's often forgotten is it's not just the main characters at this party. There is a lot larger group. And so I want you to kind of remember that and file that away as we continue to talk about this story. And so this is around 2 o'clock in the morning. So we're now into October 4th, 2002. Now, Jose, Michael, Jason, and Jaron would begin a game of dominoes, as was a regular game at these get-togethers. And as obvious, they would continue to drink. Soon, Gwen would join them. It was at this time that Jose Morell would run his hands across Gwen's throat and into her hair. Gwen pulls back and becomes very, very defensive. Jose demands, quote, "We want to know why you want everybody to fuck you in the ass," unquote. Gwen replies, quote, "How can you ask me that?" unquote. It was at this time that all four men would continue this line of questioning and ask her why she did not answer the question. Michael Madsen would tell Gwen in a loud, angry tone, quote, "Let him feel," unquote, so that everyone would know. Gwen fought back and told Madsen she would not let him molest her. At this point, someone would suggest that Michael Madsen would take Gwen into the bathroom and check her out. On the way to the bathroom, Gwen would say that she wanted to go outside for a cigarette. And I think right there, I want to pause for a second because, again, remember, setting the mood. We're in this party. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Everybody there has been drinking or taking drugs. They're all sitting around this table, and Jose runs his hands along Gwen's throat and into her hair, which has already got to, I imagine, freak her out. She's being manhandled at a party. Now they're all kind of yelling at her, and somebody suggests that one of them, in this case Michael Madsen, takes Gwen to the bathroom to check her sexual organs. I can't imagine what's going through her mind.
So right away, they're already committing a crime.
Yes, because they're not, well, yeah, and we're getting to the first of their crimes right now, because I think, again, and I don't know what was going, I can't imagine what was going through in my mind. My thought would be, if I was Gwen, I'll talk my way out of this as we're leaving the table, and I can see the door, and I'll get out the door, and then I'll be safe. I just got to get out the door. That's it. So I'll tell them whatever they want to hear. It just if I can get out the door.
Right. But when she loses the ability, basically, to consent, she has to come up with a reason she has to leave or try and,
right,
you know.
Right. Like, to me, this is assault. Like, you laid hands on a person without their consent. You're threatening them. You're starting to threaten them. and you're demanding that they expose themselves to you.
It also sounds a lot like kidnapping.
Well, and I think this next part, as we go, like, so as we go through this next stage of what's going to happen, I think that'll actually even become more clear. So on the way to the bathroom, Gwen is going to say that she wants to go outside for a cigarette. Now, Jaren neighbors at this point will tell her that she had to go to the bathroom first. And then once that was done and they cleared up this fact of whether she's, again, in air quotes, a man or a woman, then she can go outside for a smoke. In fact, Jaren neighbors go so far as to shut the door and hold it closed. This is the point to me that becomes kidnapping. Like, she wanted to leave and you said no and are forcing the door closed. So now you've laid hands on somebody. You're holding them against your will. Now, I know we're not lawyers. We're not police enforcement, but, and I know there's probably a splitting hair that it wouldn't technically be kidnapping, but it sounds a lot like it. You're holding somebody against their will. Now, Maxon will take Gwen into the bathroom, and the others of the party start discussing Gwen's gender. Jose Morel states, quote, "I swear, if it's a man, I'm gonna fucking kill him," unquote. As Morel was growing ever increasingly angry, Jaren neighbors tries to calm him down and ask him to think about what's he going to do. Jose would also continue, quote, "She ain't leaving, she ain't leaving," and just kind of repeats this over and over again. Jose would then go to the bathroom door, followed by Jaren neighbors, as he begins knocking on the door, demanding to know what's going on. Now, at this point, Michael Madsen opens the door to let him know that Gwen hasn't shown anything, and then proceeds to close the door on him. It's at this point when Nicole Brown shows up and wants to go into the bathroom. So again, let's take a step back here. You have Gwen, who's held in the bathroom against her will with Michael Madsen. You have Jose pounding on the outside of the door, being egged on. And I think you said that great, Sean, of this image of somebody feeding into somebody else's rage. And I think that's what's going on is Jaren's kind of feeding into Jose's insecurities and rage. On top of which, now enters in Nicole Brown, who we already know has issues with Gwen as per the previous altercation that happened a little bit ago. She believes that Gwen is going to be more comfortable showing another woman. So she doesn't show up to say, "Knock this off, this is ugly and disgusting, let's stop." She says, no, it'll be all right because I'm a girl. She'll definitely expose herself to me. Jaren neighbors, would then go outside for a cigarette. Jose will go out to join him as well. Michael Madsen comes out of the bathroom and told the men that he had felt two pairs of underwear and said that, quote, "Lida gotta be a man," unquote. Neighbors then tells Michael to be calm and cool and, quote, "Whatever you do, don't make a mess," unquote. Michael Madsen would put Neighbors in a chokehold and say, quote, "What about this?" unquote. According to Brown's own testimony, she will eventually come out of the bathroom and yell, "This is a fucking man. I can't believe it. I can't cope with it," unquote.
Going over the story, that just seems so childish right there. Nicole could have been the savior. All she did, she got punched by Gwen and nothing else. Nicole could have let this go. She could have helped her out the door.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that too, and we're gonna go back to that a lot because I think that is there are so many times, and I've read the court document, I've read the sources, and I know you guys have too. Reading this stuff over and over and over again, it kills me because at so many times, one person's voice could have avoided this tragedy. Yeah. One person. You know, Nicole saying, getting her out of the house. Jaren opening the door and getting her out of the house. I'm not saying it would completely negate that. I mean, terrible things can happen outside of a house as well as inside. I just think that there are so many times in this story that somebody could have made a different decision, and I think the outcome would have been completely different.
It feels like it's more than that, though, because she's not just a bystander. She's now participating in basically an assault and a kidnapping. So it seems like it goes a little further than just she's there. Could she stop it? Does that make sense?
Oh,
she's actually.
No, that's what I mean. I don't want to say that she's just a single bystander. I think some of the other people at the party could be looked at as bystanders, I think. But no, Nicole is an active participant. she has, in my mind, as guilty as any of these other people for what happened. I think had she made a different choice at this point, I think things could have went different. I don't say they would have, but I think they could have. And that's true of everybody. I think any of these people could have made a different choice, and Gwen's life would not have been snuffed out.
Hey, y'all, we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, and I'm Beth. And we want to tell you about a podcast that we host called Fruit Loops Serial Killers of Color.
Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, white dudes. No, ma'am.
Join us at Fruit Loops as we tell fascinating stories of true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that often go untold by the mainstream media. As we dive into these cases, we get into the historical and cultural context of the crimes and the criminals in order to get a sense of what might have influenced the perpetrators and led to the crimes.
And that's right. New episodes drop every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So until then, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Now, at this point, with Nicole running out and screaming, Jason Caceres goes into the bathroom and closes a door, while Jose immediately goes back to pounding on the door, yelling to be let in. Jose would then run back to his brother's bedroom, his brother Manny's bedroom. Manny's also called Emmanuel. This is the youngest brother, who had up to this point been asleep and began crying and repeating, quote, "I can't be fucking gay," unquote. Manny and neighbors would then try to talk to him and get him to calm down. Once the bathroom door is eventually opened, Jose Morel will come screaming back out and try to get in, again being prevented by getting into the bathroom by Jason Caceres. All the while, Gwen is being held in the bathroom against her will. After a moment's struggle, Morel would go into Manny's bedroom. It was there he would be consoled by Nicole Brown, who would testify, and this is what kills me. So this is her quote directly from the witness stand. Quote, "This is not your fault. You were a football player," unquote.
Man.
Like, if that has any matter on the situation at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what we're looking at is something we hear about a lot. We probably heard the phrase toxic masculinity. This is kind of exactly what this is. This idea of what men should be like. And that any deviance from that makes them more womanlike. And then that's a bad thing to be in society.
I just want to get the ages right again. We have the youngest is 19.
That's Jared Nabors.
And then everyone else is 21, 22.
They're actually, the oldest, I believe, is Michael Madsen. And I don't have the ages directly in front of me, but they're all around 22 and 24 years old, somewhere around there.
And Nicole's age?
Nicole is a little closer to the other guys. I think she is around 21 or 22, I believe.
Okay.
I think the other thing is you're right about the toxic masculinity. I think it is also, even in 2002, we have this misconception of what being gay is. Like, this guy is worried that he's gay, as if having sexual intercourse with Gwen is going to somehow make you gay, you know? Gwen's a trans woman. She's not a gay trans woman. And I think ignorance is not an excuse, and I'm not trying to say that. I think he is trying to process a bunch of stuff, but with everything else going on, that toxic masculinity kicks in, and Nicole's way of consoling him is just saying, "Well, you're a football player. That's the manliest thing you can be," which is absolute ludicrous.
Yeah, Nicole's words of coming out saying, "I can't believe it, I can't cope with it," and then saying, "You are a football player," Nicole does not seem that bright. And she seems very immature for just her own words in this whole situation.
Well, I think in that case, it's all of them.
Yeah, all of them are. He's freaking out, which, like, you're going with the toxic masculinity and everything like that, but she doesn't really... I feel like she almost likes the attention of being part of it, in a way.
I think sometimes, because of how we talk about these issues, it can get really overlooked that sexism, homophobia. There's a lot of deep homophobia in this episode. Things like racism. We often attribute those to people when really those are systems. And regardless of your gender, regardless of your sexuality, or even your race, we can all participate in that in one way or another. And so when I say toxic masculinity, I don't just mean from the male's perspective here, that they're not living up to societal standards. I also mean from her. She lives in society. She's part of that. She's used to thinking of men that way. I'm not trying to, let them off the hook or anything at all. But I think it's easy not to see that everyone's part of that same soup. Mm-hmm. And it affects how we look at each other and our own actions.
They're products of a much larger societal issue. And I think that this story is really hard because we see so many things boiled down into its essential parts. You know, this, like you said, the story at its root boils down those issues that trans people are always dealing with into a very specific point, boiling down those issues that the larger world has with coming to terms with people that are gay are boiled down to that. The sexist issues, I think, are again in even how Nicole interacts with everything. You know, even that perception that two women are fighting for the attention of men, it can be looked at as a sexist view because, you know, nowhere it was reported in one or two of the sources that was read, but I don't have any proof that that's the reason why Nicole and Gwen fought. But those kind of issues, when looked through this lens, is showing kind of a microcosm of a much larger issues that are going around societal, not just in 2002, but we're still seeing that in currently.
And homophobia is deeply rooted in sexism as well. A lot of the slurs that society has for people who are gay, a lot of the beliefs about people acting more feminine, if you're a man, that kind of stuff is deeply sexist, that there's something wrong with that, that there's something broken inside of you because who would want to be more like a woman, that kind of thing. It's a power structure. Mm-hmm. And I think even now, these ideas that, you know, if you're a man, you're tough or you're an athlete or you're whatever it is, it's terrible that men would have to feel that way. But I think this really highlights that here, coming from all sorts of people in society. And I know it's more common now for, say, football players to come out, but I still don't know that pressure in 2020 isn't still firmly on people's mind and affecting their choices.
Yeah, and I think that's something we want to highlight as we go along with this, especially with this story, but is that a lot of the issues that we've talked about in other episodes, the way immigrants are treated, I'm thinking going back into when we talked about Fong Little Pete Ching and the issues with immigration in the United States, we're still seeing that now. So a lot of the social issues that we talk about in some of these cases, the reasons why we're talking about them in part is because they're shadows of what we're seeing in the world around us today. So let's get back. As soon as the bathroom door opens this next time, Gwen's going to try to leave. And Michael Madsen is going to put her on the floor and grab her clothes and start to rip them away. He eventually rips away her underwear to reveal her testicles. Michael puts her arm around Gwen's throat and begins to choke her. Gwen's going to fight back and tries to pull him off of her. Manny's going to come out, Jose's youngest brother. He's going to come out of the back bedroom and start to pull Michael's arm aside and tells him to stop and to let her go. Michael stops briefly, at which point Manny tries to push Gwen to the front door, but was prevented to by Jaren Neighbors. So far, my understanding of this is Manny is pretty much the only person that stepped in and tried to help. He's like, knock it off, let her go, pushes her to the door. But now, again, we have another instance of you're full on trying to kidnap somebody because Jaren Neighbors prevents them from leaving out. And it's this point that Michael Madsen begins to choke Gwen again. Again, Manny's going to try to pull him away from her. And as soon as Manny kind of gets Michael off and then leaves the room, Michael jumps back and starts choking Gwen again. Nicole Brown, in her testimony, will testify that she saw Michael Madsen punch Gwen in the face and continue to choke her. It was at this time that Paul, the older of the Morrell brothers, is finally roused from his sleep and comes out and tries to break up the fight that was escalating in the living room. And at this point, Paul, Manny, and Nicole would start to prepare to leave the house. They'll eventually go out and get into Paul's truck and drive away.
So those are the three that weren't there at the initial beginning.
No, they're there at the initial beginning. Paul's asleep in the back bedroom, Nicole's at the party, and Manny's asleep as well. But at this point, as things start to escalate, Manny's tried to pull them off. Paul comes out and tells everybody to knock it off. And then Nicole says, all right, let's go. Grabs their stuff and jumps in their car and then starts to pull away. Or is getting ready to pull away. And the timeline here gets a little hazy because there is some time between when Paul initially breaks up the fight to when Nicole gets him to go in the back and start pulling his stuff together to get to leave the house. So back in the house, Caceres approaches Michael Madsen. So there's Jason Caceres and Michael Madsen, and threatens him if he didn't let Gwen go, which he does. So Jason Caceres jumps in and kind of takes the role of breaking this up. He tells Michael to stop. He does. At this point, Jaron Nabors testifies that he saw Michael's arm around Gwen's neck soon afterward. So it's one of those things where, like, not to make light, but it's like somebody comes in and says, knock it off, stop doing that, turns their back, and then Michael's back choking her again. Again, Caceres comes in and tells Michael to stop what he's doing, which he does, and then eventually will start again. So this is like the fourth or fifth time that Michael has laid hands on Gwen and has started to choke her out. Jaron Nabors will testify that he saw Jose Morell into the living room again and stood over Gwen along with Michael Madsen. One of them slapped Gwen in the head. Gwen is pleading at this point. Witnesses will say that she was pleading with her attackers, quote, no, please don't, I have a family, unquote. Morell will leave and go to the kitchen and return with some kind of food can in his hand. He then strikes Gwen on the top of her head hard enough to dent the can. Gwen will fall into a seated position. Her hair will be matted with blood. Jose will leave the room and go to the kitchen and this time return with a frying pan, which will proceed to hit Gwen in the head, again, close to the hairline around the crown of her head. Gwen will fall to the floor at this point completely. Jason Caceres will ask Jaron Nabors, quote, are you down, unquote. Jaron will testify that he understood this to mean that he was asking him if he had, quote, had their backs or not. Meaning, would he cover up for Caceres, Morell, and Madsen? He knew that he was agreeing to hurt Gwen, who was lying face down on the floor of the Morell living room. Caceres gets Michael's keys and takes Jaron Nabors to quote, get some shovels so they can kill that bitch, unquote. This was testified to by both Jaron Nabors and Nicole Brown. Brown was leaving the house with Paul and Manny. So again, the time span of this is really quick. As Paul came into the living room, broke up the fight, Nicole gets him to go back in the back bedroom and get their stuff together. It's testified later that Paul had some run-ins with the police, and Nicole was worried that if Paul got caught during this, he would be arrested and prosecuted more heavily. So as they're getting out and getting into their car, all of this other assault of Gwen is going on. At this point, Jason asks Jaron, hey, are you down? Jaron says yes. They grab Michael's keys to, again, like I said, quote unquote, go get shovels so they can kill the bitch. And as they're jumping in the car to leave, they actually see Paul, Manny, and Nicole in Paul's truck, and they actually have an exchange through open windows where Jaron tells them, oh yeah, we're going to go get shovels at my house. Or I'm sorry, Jason tells them, we're going to go get shovels at my parents' house, and we'll be back. And the two cars pull off, which to me is astounding that you would hear that and not call the police or freak out or stay. Or I mean, I'd like to think that anybody else in that position would do something differently. My fear is that a lot of people wouldn't.
How comfortable everyone seemed, and in a way, they know where to go get shovels. They know the steps. It's a little organized. Could they have done this before?
I don't know. Nothing's ever said about that, but it does make you wonder that people's comfortability or the level of their comfort when it comes to doling out violence and then cleaning up after themselves, it is really frightening.
Especially since it seems like it only took one change and they no longer see Gwen really as a person. Now it's just, what are they going to do with this body? And
right.
How are they going to handle the situation to keep each other safe? Not that they treated her all that well prior to this, but it's a very quick change.
Yeah. Like I said, nothing's ever said. I'm not insinuating that happened in the prior to this event. It's just very, very frightening that they went from a bunch of people at a party drinking, getting high and playing dominoes to we're assaulting another living human being and we're going to get shovels to kill her and then bury her somewhere.
I think that's where it's important to know that they have been talking about this stuff for a while.
As I said, yeah, this is going to come up, and I wanted you to remember that, is that they have been, according to certain testimony, they have been talking about this for a few weeks. There will be other testimony that will conflict with this, and they'll say that they actually hadn't been talking about it, and it was all a big joke, and we were just kidding. But I think a lot of times that excuse of, oh, it was just in jest, or it wasn't serious, is used as a way of covering up what you're really thinking about, and I think this is one of those cases. So eventually, the two men are going to get back, and they're going to return with shovels and pickaxes taken from the Caceres' house. When the two men get back into the house, Gwen is actually on a sitting position on the couch and seems to be conscious, but there is blood all over her face, and there's blood on the floor in front of her. The other two were there as well, Michael Madsen and Jose Morel. They're standing in front of her. Morel, this is Jose Morel, is holding a dumbbell with weights attached to it, while Michael Madsen left and returned shortly with like a length of rope. It's not really clear of how long the length of rope is from the descriptions and the way they talked about it. It sounded like it was more like a few feet. It's not like an actual like coil of rope, but it's just a small length of rope. Jose would then tell Gwen to get off the couch and proceed to scrub it down and remove the blood, which... this is all a terrible story. I think this, again, it highlights what you were just saying, Jessica, about them not seeing her as a person anymore. He's more concerned with the carpet and the couch more than the fact that he's beaten this woman half to death.
And she moved on her own?
The testimony is not clear. So again, what I'm reading you is facts taken from the prosecution's court documents, which means this is, as far as the court is concerned, this is the actual facts of the case. So the only fact that was testified to was that she was on the couch. She was on the floor, and when people left, when they came back, they were on the couch. Nobody testified to how she got back on the couch, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Now, both Jason Caceres and Jaron Nabors yell at Madsen to knock that bitch out, quote unquote. He struck Gwen with a closed fist, and she's dropped to the floor, where he knees her twice in the face. So hard, in fact, that her face is going to fly back and her head's going to dent the drywall behind her. She's then tied up, feet and hands, and moved to a blanket. It was there she was carried to the garage. Now, Jaron Nabors would later testify that when he saw Michael Madsen grab this loose piece of rope that he brought back in from somewhere, and bring it up towards Gwen's upper body. This is going to be very important when determining exactly how Gwen will be murdered. Michael Madsen and Jason Caceres would carry Gwen out to the garage and into the bed of the truck that was waiting. She was wrapped up in a blanket that they had originally put her in. The men would then pile into the truck, but not before Jaron Nabors would change his shirt for one of Michael's, as Jaron did not want to get his shirt dirty. And Jose would lock the front door. Again, the idea that you have a still living body wrapped up in a blanket in the bed of your truck, and you're worried about your shirt getting dirty. The callousness that these men showed is, I don't care what they think she did or who they think she is absolutely astounding. And the tragedy of this is, and we'll talk about this as we go along, and I'm sure if you're listening to this, you probably are aware, this is not an isolated incident. I know, Jessica, you talked about some of the statistics, that violence against trans people perpetrated in this way is not an isolated, it's not a one-off. This can be a common occurrence for the trans community, especially trans women of color.
So after he locks the door, does this mean... I'm guessing that most of the people who were there, that weren't these main seven people, the people who were just partying, they've also left?
That's an interesting question. There is no mention of them. I could not in the court documents. Now, again, the court documents we had did not mention them. The newspaper articles that have a little there's a few conflicting results or conflicting reporting on that. Me reading between the lines and doing some research, it seemed like, yes, at some point a lot of these people left, but I can't say for certainty that there weren't some people still in the house. I imagine if he's locking the front door, the majority of them have already left. I would assume they probably started leaving when stuff started happening with earlier when they forced Gwen into the bathroom. One of the men had suggested throwing Gwen off a bridge. Michael stated that he had not been sure on whether or not Gwen was dead until, quote-unquote, he had hit her with a shovel a couple of times. The he that Michael was referring to was someone other than himself. Now, again, this is brought up at trial later. The reason why I'm spelling that out is because there is a question about who actually will end up killing Gwen, and the defendants in this case are going to use that to their advantage. The group finally decides to take Gwen to Silver Fork Campground in the El Dorado Forest, a place that Jason Caceres and Michael Madsen had been before to camp. This is a 164.3-mile trip that would take them 2 hours and 37 minutes. So again, the calmness and almost dispassionate nature of, we need, because in some of these cases we've talked about, and even some of the ones that we're researching for the future, ones that we've talked about, you know, bodies are disposed of relatively near to where they were killed, or they're taking, you know, it's not many of our cases where the victims are disposed of in this kind of manner where they've really thought, I mean, I think looking back to like the Kerry Stainer case, even those were relatively close to where they were murdered. These four men are driving 2 hours away from where they killed or where the assault initially took place to dispose of Gwen's body. Now, once they get to their destination, they pull off on an unpaved road and dug a shallow grave. Now, as they're digging, Michael Madsen even kicks Gwen's body a couple of more times. They put her into the hole and fill it with rocks, dirt, and then move a log on top of this makeshift grave. They got back into their truck and drove home. Along the drive, they discussed the killing, and with their discussion, they decided that they were hungry, so they stopped at a McDonald's along the way for breakfast before they returned to Newark and went to sleep. I think that's one of the most chilling parts of that story, is that after all of this, they stop at a McDonald's to have breakfast and an Egg McMuffin and then drive the rest of the way home.
I think it's crazy. You got to think about drinking. They're drinking at two different bars and nightclubs.
Right.
They get back, this happens, and then they drive 2.5 hours drunk, probably tired, unless the drugs that they're using are keeping them up. Adrenaline also, I understand.
Right.
It's just this, such a long night. And then they discuss it, and to be able to eat is just disgusting.
And it goes back, again, to go back to that point you made, Jessica, about if there's no other part of the story that shows their abject, not even disgust, but they're looking at Gwen as not a human being. I think it's that I can calmly drive home, grab a quick McDonald's breakfast, and go to sleep and not give it a second thought of what we did.
I mean, everything has been her fault, according to them.
Yeah.
You know, that they had sex, that she wasn't exactly how they wished she had been while right. They were having sex, that meant she had to die, that she was getting blood on the couch or someone's shirt. I mean, the audacity to think that you are owed anything in these circumstances, it just boggles my mind. You already put yourself way above this victim, probably right when you met her, if that makes sense.
It will later be revealed that when Gwen's body was found, that the cause of death was asphyxia due to strangulation, associated with blunt force trauma to the head. There were two lacerations on the upper forehead with hemorrhaging inside the scalp. The blows were caused by a hard blunt object, which could have been a heavy-duty frying pan or a can of food applied with enough force, a shovel, or a weight. It is possible that either the blunt force trauma or the strangulation were potentially fatal, and death could have occurred from either of them. It was also determined that after the blows, she could have been conscious or even somewhat able to communicate and possibly even move on her own. In other words, her body was put through so much torture that it was impossible to find out which of the blows or the strangulation had killed her. But one thing was certain. Gwen was conscious for most of it, and she lived out the remaining moments of her life in terror and pain. And these people could have stopped it at any time, and Gwen might have still been alive with us today. We're going to end here with this episode. In the next installment, we'll talk about the days after the killing and what will lead to the men's arrests and the drama that will begin with the trial.
For tonight's cold case, we will be talking about Jasmine Sierra, a trans woman of color who was found on January 22, 2016, in an apartment on the 1000 block of Monterey Street in Bakersfield, California. Police will state that her body showed signs of trauma and will say that foul play is likely the cause of her death. Police interviewed neighbors who will comment on hearing gunshots and fighting, but will not release statements about the circumstances of Sierra's death. Jasmine experienced being misgendered and deadnamed by the police who were handling her case. In fact, her friends and family would not be notified of her death until 2 months after she had died because of this issue. This highlights a terrible and reoccurring issue of both police and the media not knowing how to handle cases involving the trans and gender variant communities. This type of mishandling can be a contributing factor to some of these cases going unsolved and unknown by the general public. The information about this case is almost non-existent, and in fact, she is not even listed on the Bakersfield Police Department's Unsolved Cases page. If you have any information about Jasmine's death, please call the Bakersfield Police Department at 661-327-7111 and help Jasmine's family and friends finally see justice.
If you or someone you love is dealing with issues related to being trans, there are people who can help. Contact the National Center for Transgender Equality at transequality.org. They have a wealth of resources and a number of people who can help with all sorts of issues, including healthcare, insurance, legal resources, immigration, international resources, and even veterans affairs. We will be posting these links and more on our website, californiatruecrime.com. Take the time to reach out and help end the hate and bigotry.
Thank you for listening to our coverage of the second part of the murder of Gwen Orejo. Don't forget to rate and review our podcast on the platform of your choice. This really does help us get the word out. As always, you can visit us on Twitter and Instagram at Cali True Crime, as well as join our Facebook group at California True Crime. Take a look at our website, californiatruecrime.com, which has our blog, as well as our new store where you can get some Cali True Crime merch for your family, friends, coworkers, and strangers. We also have a Patreon page up and running with levels for every budget and the option of ad-free episodes. This is also a huge way that you can support the show and help us bring you the episodes and the research that you have come to expect. We can't not also thank She Who Must Do Quality Control, Melanie Duncan. This has been recorded at Snail Ranch Studios and The Hangar and is a production of Wade Grimace.